Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. By 2030, up to 800 million global workers will lose their jobs to automation. That's according to a new report by the McKinsey Global Institute. This is not the first time that technology has played this disruptive role. But this time is different, according to Richard Baldwin of the Graduate Institute in Geneva. Baldwin is the author of the new book, The Globotics: Upheaval, Globalization, Robotics, and the Future of Work. He'll discuss his thesis with my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Marcus Kounoulakis.
Richard, welcome, and it's good to see you. I'm hoping that you do not scare us all tonight with what it is that you've presented. Richard has written a book that is quite anxiety-inducing, in particular for you in the audience tonight, because I'm assuming we don't have a whole lot of people who are either farming or working in the manufacturing sector. And I think he will bring to light a number of issues that are true of not just today, but of the immediate future, which are the future of work, the changes that we're witnessing both because of globalization and robotics. And as I say, this is quite anxiety-inducing. So maybe you can tell us why you're trying to scare us, Richard.
Right. Well, so it's not, well, I read a book on public speaking, and it turns out when you scare people, their analytic facilities flare up.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, what's rustling in the back? So everybody starts listening when you say it. But that's actually not it. I'm seriously worried that globalization is coming faster than most people expect. And it's coming to the service and professional jobs, not the manufacturing jobs. But most people are thinking the future is going to be like the past. So I believe that both automation and globalization will impact service workers big time, very fast, and these people are not ready for it. And they're not ready for it because they've never seen automation, because computers couldn't think before. And they've never seen globalization because face-to-face is so important in so many services, and basically there was a technical barrier to arbitraging wage differences in the service sector. But digital technology is changing both those realities. Computers are gaining cognitive capacities they never have, which are creating some substitutes for some professional and white-collar workers. And globalization of telecommuting is creating direct competition for some American workers. Also opportunities, but I think for many of the people, it will be the competition that's concerning them.
Right. So what we've seen so far then in the globalization process has really been the question of goods rather than services. The change in the status of workers, whether and primarily in the developed countries, has been that, in, as you put it, the arbitrage, the gaming of the differences of the cost of labor in another country versus the cost of labor and goods and capital in another country. Mm. So we've been gaming that, essentially.
Absolutely.
And that's how people make money. And so in that game, we get cheaper goods from places where they're less expensive to produce. But what you're saying is we're moving from that model of goods to services.
Absolutely. So I like the way you said it, and that's basically my theory of globalization, is that you should think about globalization as arbitrage. So if things cost different amounts in different countries, somebody exploits that by making it or buying it here and selling it there. And since it's a relative price, there's a two-way deal to be had. Now, much of those price differences have been taken off in goods. The prices aren't that different. And a lot of, there has been a big arbitrage in knowledge, which I think has been going on with the global value chain. But the really, really big price differences left in the world are the price of service sector workers, where, say, a nurse can cost 1/20th the time in Kenya compared to, say, Germany. That's normal. And the only barriers to arbitraging those differences are technological. And what's
would I also say regulatory in some instances?
Well, there are, so some for some things like lawyers and doctors and
yes.
stuff, but
the,
but many, many of them, let's mm-hmm. say bookkeepers, accountants, assistants, travel agents,
right.
those sorts of things are not regulatory.
Yeah.
It's technical barriers. And what digital technology is tearing down those barriers at an incredible pace. And the you know that as those barriers come down, companies will increasingly arbitrage the differences. So you know, I'm not making this up. I mean, if you look at what Upwork does,
Yes, I actually have been to the Upwork site.
Oh, there
it really
go.
Is. It's quite a good site. It's sort of like, well, what would I compare it to? I guess you're really looking and searching like you do on Amazon for books, but you're searching for clerical help or for other types of professional services. I have a friend who actually sells voice services to voice various videos and the like around the world.
There you go. So, my favorite analogy is Alibaba or eBay.
Oh, yeah.
So, in essence, they allowed us to find buyers and sellers of, even including strange things, arrange the payment, arrange the shipment, and underpin it with some sort of insurance thing. And free Upwork, and there's a whole competition going on in the world, Freelancer and all these. And they're essentially doing the same for services. And you find, hire, pay, manage. You can fire, quality checking, all that stuff is done on Upwork. And those services, although they are kind of going, they're growing at 20-30% per year. And that means that the work being done across borders is growing at that same pace.
Right, so it's a match.com or a willing buyer and willing seller and just putting together with this platform, but really disintermediating in many ways that process of how do you find somebody who's so far flung and can do this accounting work, as you suggest.
Exactly. So let me tell you a story. I hired, I run this website, was mentioned, voxeu.org, which is research-based policy and analysis by economists for economists. And we needed a new copy editor, so I went on Upwork, and I found this woman who sits in Bangkok, and she is a Japanese national, grew up in the United States, speaks fluent English, and is living in Bangkok but can't work in Bangkok. So she used to be an UN administrator, and now she's doing copy editing for $15 an hour. And it's tremendous. How would I have ever found this woman? Now, the thing you said about disintermediation I think is really important, that a lot of globalization up to now was driven by large corporations and large organizations, including services. But this is one tiny little website hiring one person in Bangkok, and paying, I think it ends up, maybe $50 a week at the most.
Right.
So it's micro, and so it really is democratizing this kind of access. And I think that has some implications that will make it hard for people to know that it's actually going on, because it kind of creeps in such a small places.
Right.
There's no factory that shuts down and we know that it was China or robots that put them out of work. It's, one little task at a time, gradual. But I think eventually it will really transform the way we work.
And are you predicting when that will hit us? When will we be conscious of it? Is, if it's a death by a thousand cuts to service sector jobs, when do we bleed to death?
So, I don't know. When you do forecasting, you should give a number or a date, but never both. let's put it this way. I would be surprised if this doesn't enter into the 2020 election as an issue of people losing jobs, right, both to software robots and telemigrants that is being replaced. Because one of the things is it will strike American workers as incredibly unfair. They don't pay taxes. There's no labor laws. They don't ask for pay or perks, no sick days. And that, I think, will feel very unfair, both the robots and the software. So my feeling is that we'll start, but you can't predict these social backlashes.
Sure.
But I think it will come quickly. And it's always worthwhile remembering that these things are processes, not events.
Yeah.
And at some point, it'll be like the LA riot is when they finally struck back.
Yes.
But that was a part of a process.
Yes.
And so that it's hard to say, but faster than most people think.
Well, this is concerning because, as you say, it's happening with goods. It's happening with factory workers, whether it's the robotics reality of automobile manufacturing lines and other areas where we're seeing higher unemployment in various industries. But you're also saying that in parallel, and maybe even in a faster manner because of the real frictionless reality of the digital revolution, that we will also be having this well-educated, highly compensated, comfortable part of an electorate or of a citizenry that is really going to have to worry about its jobs.
Absolutely. So I would actually point to two things. One, look around you and see who's telecommuting to work and what they're doing. If you want to know where this will come first, you found those people. If you're telecommuting and doing half your job from remote, your company will eventually figure out, and not too long, that they can replace at least part of what you do with somebody who costs one-tenth the price and is, doesn't require pay leaves or sick or anything like that. And these are highly trained people. The second thing I'd really like to stress is machine translation. And if you have not tried machine translation in the last 6 months or a year, you have to. It's incredibly good, and it's getting incredibly good very, very fast because of an enormous data set that the UN put online and other parliaments have put online. And then the AI geniuses trained these models to translate sentence by sentence, not word by word. So it's incredibly good. And when you think about that, that means hundreds of millions of talented, low-cost foreigners who were excluded from the service market are joining the service market because now they speak good enough English,
right,
or French or Spanish. So that, I think, in some sense, you could say the 90s was a story when low-skilled workers from, just say, India and China, hundreds of millions of them, joined the workforce in manufacturing. And that transformed things in the 90s. Now that's happening in service because digital technology is making remote people less remote, machine translations letting them speak English, and the wage differences is making it profitable to arbitrage these. So I think of this as a talent tsunami. And I think people in the rich countries who feel themselves very special will pretty soon feel themselves a lot less special because there's lots of other people who can do more or less the same thing for much less.
That, as I said at the very outset, is anxiety inducing. And it really is a question because you're, you know, at this point in the United States, a lot of the conversation is about labor and migrants. And one of the things you said was telemigration and teleconferencing. And so you're talking about a type of migration that really is, regardless of how you feel about physical barriers, really impossible to stop.
Right.
I guess I shouldn't say impossible in that Russia recently announced that it was going to shut down its connections to the rest of the world with the internet,
right,
in order to test whether or not, they say, what would happen under a cyber attack reality, where how would their systems function in a closed system. But there's a second part to that, which is, of course, testing whether or not they themselves should shut down those systems and really practice both information sovereignty and dependence on their own existing economic and informational systems.
Right. So let me come back to a little more anxiety just in case I haven't raised your anxiety enough. But let me say a good thing for the moment. Now, I see in this audience probably most of you are winners, which means you're in the service sector and you're globally competitive. And this will allow you to sell to a bigger client base. And so in this whole import-export goes both ways, but globalization always is more opportunities for a nation's most competitive citizens, but more competition for its least competitive citizens. So if you're a competitive citizen, this is all good news, and also for people in the emerging markets. But let me come back to this can you control things. I mean, one of the problems with this is governments have good technology to control people, capital, and goods crossing borders. They don't have very good tools for controlling services crossing borders. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have all the international governance we need already. Let me just give you an example of what I'm talking about here. So I have a friend in Switzerland who does websites very quickly, and he will set up, he gets online, he has like four screens, and he has a programmer from Pakistan online for 2 days, a user experience person from Canada online for 2 days, a designer from Uruguay, and they work together in a virtual office, and in 2 or 3 days they do a great website. And this is totally standard in web development and logo development and a number of other places. And I'm just saying that's going to go global.
Yes.
And so this guy, he has an amazing coder, which he probably couldn't even hire in California because he's taken up by somebody else, has an amazing user experience person, et cetera. And they could never do that in Switzerland, and if they did, it would be incredibly expensive. So I'm just thinking that's going to go mainstream. And that's my, that's more or less I feel comfortable. I don't say it might, I think it will. and it already has in certain sectors.
And you're not seeing at this point any form of governmental attempts at control or management of this suddenly quite challenging labor reality that you are seeing this arbitraged, less expensive labor, quite expert, crossing borders, avoiding or, end running the tax system, being able to create all types of revenue challenges for nation states and at the same time labor problems for those who are unionized. I mean, what types of reactions are you seeing at this early stage, or at least this stage where it doesn't feel as if we have a global consciousness of what exactly is happening?
Right, nothing. I see nothing. So I was in Davos a few weeks ago, and I talked to Stefan Kessler, who's the CEO of Upwork, and I asked him, well, what do you do about taxation? Aren't people mad that these guys don't pay taxes? And he says, well, if it's a U.S. person, we give a 1099. We report the miscellaneous income to them and the government. But a lot of governments don't even ask. So Sri Lanka doesn't ask what Upwork pays to Sri Lankan-based people. And Kessler said, well, if they asked, I'll give it to them. But the awareness of this hasn't happened at that level. And when you think about it, it's very hard because we all like telecommuting, and we're sort of moving into telecommuting. That sounds good. And domestic telecommuting, international telecommuting, I mean, there's no hard line there. And people wouldn't want to say, okay, we all have to be in the office. I mean, that's why I think there is no consciousness on it. And I think it will come up and we'll have some scandals about it. But there's no international governance that hinders it. Well, let me say, there's one thing. You can use privacy regulations in certain industries. Mm-hmm. So in Switzerland, we have very strong bank privacy laws, as you may have heard of.
Yes.
And if client data leaves Switzerland, people go to jail. And as a consequence, none of the back office stuff is ever offshored. All the stuff that Bank of America does in Philippines, that's done in Switzerland because they can't move it out of the country. So you could use some sort of privacy things maybe to stop it, but that's not going to stop me from getting an assistant to organize my calendar or explain to me how to straighten out the contacts in my smartphone or something like that. So the regulation can work for a few heavily regulated industries, but not for other stuff.
Right. And so as you were describing this question of the taxation system, it reminded me of the early days of early online commerce, where in the United States we failed to have a sales tax system that was able to capture the amount of transactional work that was being done, and therefore working quite rapidly to undermine street-side businesses, retail outlets, the type of ways that we would otherwise purchase our clothing.
Bookshops, primarily.
It seemed there that government was late to the game to try and really recognize what in fact was heading towards them and towards their revenue base. And what you then have and what we're now seeing is a reaction to some of this. And although I don't think it's come to any solution or conclusion at this point.
So this is not a policy book. This is going down to the village square and ringing the bell. Wake up, it's coming. It's coming for you and you're not ready for it. That's the book. But I'm a policy guy deep down.
Yeah.
And I think there are things we could do. So the container ships of this globalization are these web platforms, these freelancing web platforms. And at the very least, and there's a global competition, but most of them are in the rich countries. There's a big Chinese one called Witmart. In China, it's called Zubaiji. But in any case, most of them are in the big developed countries. We could have simply a code of good conduct. Mm-hmm. Let's say, no 12-year-old children tagging photos, for instance, report the tax revenue. And so the fact that a lot of this is coming, at least initially, through the freelancing platforms, I think gives us some way of controlling it. Now, you can't, if you try and tax it crazy, they'll just move it off to the Bahamas or something. But I think a lot of these platforms, they don't want to be another Uber. They want to play the game. And, there's plenty of surplus for everybody. $10 an hour in Philippines is a very good salary and still very cheap in America. And if somebody has to pay $2 a tax on that, I don't think that would destroy the whole business model. So I think that might be one angle towards it.
Right. But as you say, it's not a policy book, and it is a warning to us all and a wake-up call about what it is that's in fact happening. You know, you mentioned within...
I do have a happy ending, but we will get to that later.
We will get to the happy ending because we're not leaving here before we get to the happy ending. Okay. It would be remiss of me to avoid that. But I think before we get there, we should maybe look at some of the aspects, and one of which you mentioned earlier, which was this question of medicine, for example, right? And I think as you look here in the United States, perhaps not so much in other countries where there are social welfare systems that are developed and where they have health systems that are run by the government, but in the United States, where a big part of our GDP is eaten up by healthcare costs, the prospect of that you raise of this ability to have telemedicine, for lack of a better term, could in fact change the game dramatically from the cost side of the house, right? And that affects not just the higher skilled laborers and workers that we're talking about who are going to be affected by this service change, but it also affects those who are already feeling the pinch of globalization and in the labor workforce, right? Yeah. So how have you thought through, and I'm sure you have, but maybe you could tell us a bit about what those changes could look like.
Well, let me start with telemedicine. That you didn't make that word up. That's a thing.
Okay.
People do telemedicine all the time, where doctors will treat a patient in one hospital and then they talk to the patient remotely without going to the hospital using telepresence robots or telepresence rooms. That happens all the time now just because, you know, it's so expensive to move doctors.
I'm curious, has anybody in this room ever done a telemedicine anything? Yes, I see one, two, three. Yeah. So out of 80 people, three people.
It's starting. And yes. And they even do telesurgery, like in Canada, where the guy will die before he could get to the hospital, so they have this robot that's controlled remotely. And so it's a thing, telemedicine's a thing, and it's exactly driven by the fact that there's a lack of doctors and medicine and something that's often urgent. So I think that actually will be an important thing. There, maybe it won't be so disruptive, because almost every rich country is short of doctors and nurses and nurses' assistants, and I think we would all like to spend more on healthcare if it was reasonably priced. Just personally, I have these little skin things all the time, and now I can take a picture of it and send it off to some guy, I don't know where he is, but for $5, he'll tell me, is it a freckle, or is it something you should go get checked? And, you know, I'm very happy to spend this money. And this is more automation, but the National Health Service in England has an app which helps you decide whether you should go to the GP or not. You know, like I've got a runny nose and a headache and this and that, and it asks you how long it is. And it'll say, you know, rush to the hospital or take an aspirin and call me in the morning. And I think this will be a big cost thing in medicine.
Well, that's really raises the next question, which is not just the question of whether or not we can arbitrage individuals, but as you just mentioned with this example in the National Health Service, there's an element of AI, of artificial intelligence, which also can overlay with this new reality of this, as you refer to it, globotics.
Globotics, yes.
Which is globalization and robotics, right? But if you are able to then mesh the two, that is, use the types of big data collection that we have and the types of computing power that exists, whether it be on the cloud or in terrestrial areas as in Switzerland, by meshing those two, you can actually come out with quicker outcomes and in many ways even be able to do away with that lower labor force, that service labor force that is less expensive.
Right.
You talk about, or maybe you should talk about, a little bit about the artificial intelligence factor?
So let me, I can't resist you raised the bait with globotics. So
yes.
I've had about a dozen reviews of this book and every single one of them went out of the way to say what an ugly word that was. But then I'm going like, yeah, that's right, you'll remember it. An ugly but memorable word that reminds you that digital technology is affecting globalization as well as robots. Every day you read about the robots, but people have forgotten about the globalization. So thank you for that opportunity to say that. But
it is an ugly word, by the way.
It is an ugly word, wait till I start talking about globots instead of globotics. It's even worse. But the automation thing, I think, is also important to be said. So basically, because of machine learning, and AI is a huge area, and I would focus on machine learning, where they use a big structured data set to train a model to guess things. And what this has done is, I see that I have tech guys in the audience here. This is San Francisco, so I have to be a bit careful. We'll get into it afterwards and I can learn something. But anyways, the basic thing is that since they're programming computers in this way very differently than they did before, they're not writing code, they're estimating big statistical models. Computers have very recently, and I'm talking like since 2016, acquired a whole set of thinking capacities, cognitive capacities that they never had. So computers now can see, read, think, write, generate output in a fairly natural way. They couldn't just a few years ago. Now, some of those capacities are gateway skills in the workplace. And one of the big ones I mentioned before is machine translation.
Right.
That was basically, now, you know, you talk to Google Translate or one of these things. I walked around China and got from Tianjin to Beijing Airport with the conversation mode like this.
Right, so that was just a real-time translating opportunity and platform.
Yeah, and it was good. These new capacities are substitutes for certain types of service jobs.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that people haven't got on very quickly yet. So one example where you can see it, I don't know if you travel in Europe, they frequently let you through on you scan your passport, and there's a camera which recognizes you are the guy in the passport, and you go through without talking to a person. And that was not possible before. So in Zurich now, there'll be 10 lanes of machines and two guys back there. And this is a country that really cares about their border.
Yes.
They would never have let you in without the guy looking at you. And now the machines are so good that they trust it going in. So we haven't got the killer app yet, but people are putting it together and providing substitutes for certain types of thinking. And I think it's important to say that this is not like the last one. It's not necessarily the lowest skilled workers are going to get it worst.
Right.
Because machine learning, in some sense, is database pattern recognition. And if you think about, I can see there are a lot of professional people here, a lot of what you get paid for is experience-based pattern recognition, whether it's in law or accounting or medicine. And machine learning is training things to do experience-based pattern recognition. So if they can gather a great big structured data set to do this part of your job, that part of your job will be automated soon. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the lowest skilled jobs. So I think the white collar, middle class, professional jobs will find this disturbing in some ways.
Yes, and even within those professions, as you say, it may not be the entire aspect of the profession, but it may be a big part. It may get rid of, paralegals who are spending a lot of their time trying to look up things within law books, but it may not get rid of the lawyers themselves.
Right, not completely. But one thing that when I was reading this literature, I'm not an AI.
Shakespeare would be very happy, by the way. He's getting rid of the lawyers.
Especially the copy editing.
Yeah.
But the thing I read about, that bothered me when I was reading, I'm not an AI expert, but I read a huge amount of this, that there's a systematic misunderstanding of what AI is. So people think of these machine learning or AI as a robo-lawyer, as like a baby lawyer. You know, he's like in kindergarten, but eventually he'll graduate from high school and go to law school and be just like a lawyer. And I think that's completely wrong. What you got to think about these things is like a tractor. And a tractor's not like a baby farmer who is now good at some things and eventually will be able to do the entire farming job. It's a very precise tool that does very precise things. My tech guys are nodding now, so I'm feeling much better about this. And so it will change everybody's job, but mostly it can't do all of anybody's job. So what we're talking about is a lot of job displacement, but not removing occupations. I've been interviewed on radios a little bit the last few days, and you know, one guy went through, well, which of these four professions are still going to be here in 5 years? And I go, all of them, but fewer people on each one. Right. And all of our jobs will change, and we don't know how. So I think that's important to say, is this is, for some people, like some lawyers are using this to become much better lawyers.
Yeah.
The machine reads through all the rulings of the judge they're going to on the topic and picks out what the lawyer seems to think is important in terms of principle laws or precedents, and then they recast their argument according to what they think will ring.
Sure.
And you know that you could have done that with a room full of paralegals, but now you can do it with a machine overnight.
We've been hearing from Richard Baldwin, author of the new book, The Globotics Upheaval, Globalization, Robotics, and the Future of Work. After the break, he'll discuss what skills will be needed to compete in the global economy dominated by automation. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Richard Baldwin. He's professor at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. He's the author of a new book, The Globotics Upheaval. Moderating the program is Marcus Kounoulakis. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you might have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
We've seen what are referred to as the weakening of the nation state, right? So if you have these international labor forces that do not allow for these institutions, whether they be labor institutions, union institutions, or even manufacturing institutions to continue to exist or to transform in some way, that has disrupted the politics of this country, for example, most recently in the 2016 election, and also done what I've suggested, which is perhaps weaken aspects of the nation state itself. What you're saying is coming down the road seems to even have a more profound reality, because many of those workers are already operating on an international basis, or at least interacting on an international basis consciously. What then does that also mean, perhaps, for the politics of a country?
So the second word in my title is upheaval.
Yes.
So you're sort of alluding to the politics. We do not know what's going to happen. This is the future, and the future is unknowable. So, you know, I'm just making it up. I say will, but, you know, who knows? This is poker. There's certain possibilities and certain probabilities. And if you read some of the experts, it's going to be tens of millions of jobs spread over 10, 20 years. No problem. Some of the experts say hundreds of millions of jobs over 5 years, then that's going to be a problem. So we don't know which way, but my feeling is that there will be a bit of an upheaval in domestic politics. And in terms of the control of the sort of denationalization of thing, I think that will continue. But I'm wondering if, you know, in the book I speculate what the backlash might look like. And we don't know if it's going to happen, but it not. But, you know, I think a good bet now is that big tech companies, which are so easy to hate to start with. And I think that people may view this as technology doing it to them, both through telemigrants and through the automation, and that the real big problem is technology. So that might one, it's not a popular thing to say here in San Francisco, but I think that people are a little mad about different things, and that might be one backlash. And that's not really a national thing. But it could lead to a nationalist background, a sort of circle the wagons kind of thing, and that might make the nation state stronger. But the general drift of denationalizing politics, I think that is a possibility. On the other hand, you know, like you talked about Russia disconnecting from the internet and,
yes,
and the European Union making it hard to move data and China doing its own thing, so it may also potentially lead to a more national thing. Everything that's on the internet becoming more national. So
right. So either on the one hand, everything flows a lot more easily and things open up, or everybody reacts to this at a national level and says, you know, we really have to protect the few things that we think we can protect,
yeah,
and build stronger borders, higher firewalls, or entirely disconnect from the
right
system.
It's really good you said firewall rather than wall.
Yes.
because the war will not stop these telemigrants.
That's right. Well, you know, you live in Europe, and one of the things that we observe here in Europe is that as a result of the first globalization transformation, there is a high level of youth unemployment. And maybe it's not just because of the globalization and maybe structural issues within Europe. And what you probably have witnessed is that there are great, not telemigrations, but actually physical migrations from some of the southern European countries into the northern European countries. Is that something that we will also see as a result of this service transformation? Will the service unemployed start migrating both physically as well as via their telemigration?
Well, so I think it's hard to know what's going to happen in the very, very short term. But basically, this is creating jobs for people who stay at home, not people who are moving. So in some sense, this is an enormous export opportunity for emerging markets. And I think the emerging market miracle will continue and spread. But it'll look more like India's success, where they did it on services, not China's success, where they did it on goods. And so in principle, it's a good thing. There are a couple of countries, Singapore and Japan, for instance, where I've been to very recently, and the governments are intentionally using automation to avoid low-skilled immigration. They, for instance, in Singapore, they've subsidized using tablets to order the drinks, so they need fewer waitresses. And I was in a hotel where the room service was delivered by a robot, you know, like one of these ones they use in the hospital. And I was in a restaurant where they had a robotic busboy picking up dishes and stuff like that. And that's explicitly to avoid migration. So I think there's some of that. Same in Japan. They want to avoid getting migrants in. And so they're automating stuff and using telerobots and telemigration, like teaching English remotely rather than having English teachers come in. So I do think there's a substitution ultimately. And if it does, look at India. I mean, India, with their export of services, they did it. This wasn't telemigration with India. It was like we sent the work to them, and then he did it, and they sent it back. But that growth, that rapid growth of incomes, created a rising middle class, which created lots of jobs in India for Indians. So I think that ultimately, you know, as you create jobs for people in emerging markets, they would much rather stay home.
Yes.
So personally, I think they're substitutes.
Right. We tend to take questions here, and I've got a number of 3x5 cards from the audience, and one is from a gentleman named David Kendall. And since you're an economist, you regularly study rates of growth and these other data-driven issues. He asks, do you see the rate of change in telemigration, et cetera, as an exponential? And he explains exponential one as posited by Ray Kurzweil. So how do you, when you sort of take it apart from an econometric perspective, right, how do you look at that rate of change?
So you're talking about, you know, the singularity Ray
yes.
guy. Okay. So he goes too far. I mean, in economics, we know we have diminishing returns eventually. You get the low-hanging fruit. That's what's going on now. And eventually, it starts to get difficult, and it slows down. Just like with the outsourcing and offshoring. But let's leave Ray out of this. So technically, any constant growth rate curve becomes exponential. That's more or less the definition. The trouble is we tend to gauge progress in increments. We, as human instinctively, we think that the increment of progress in the future will be like the increment of progress in the past. And that means we're straight-lining the future. But the progress doesn't work in a straight line. It works like this with the exponential curve. So that the answer is the exponential growth is constant, will stay constant for at least 5 or 10 years, but it's the same growth that's been going on since Richard Nixon was president.
Right.
This doubling every 2 years. So that growth rate is constant. It's just the increments tend to get explosively large, and people naturally think in increments rather than growth rates.
Right.
So I don't know if that's an answer, but at least I talked for a little while.
Yeah, well, and it also addressed what you said earlier, which is you actually perceive that it might have an effect on the 2020 election, which is only a year and
yeah.
a half away.
So there's a candidate named Andrew Yang
uh-huh.
who's running on this platform. It's like the big tech companies are doing to it. The driverless cars are going to cause a revolution. And his big thing is put in a value-added tax to pay for a universal basic income. Now, this guy's unelectable and probably just trying to sell books, something I can understand. But I think people on the left in the United States will pick up some of these themes to channel the anger and fragility that people experience into something that isn't anti-migration and isn't anti-foreign. Anti-tech is what it is. So I'm be quite surprised if some of the left-leaning candidates in the Democratic Party don't embrace some of this anti-tech, anti-automation themes.
Yes, in fact, we've had a couple of questions here.
Oh, very good.
Just about that. And it really is a question, because what you're saying is that within all of these transformational moments, and you are looking at this as an inflection point, right?
Absolutely.
But there's a period where you have to then reach a new equilibrium of some sort. Is that right? But that that interim moment, which we are currently living in, is that a fair estimation?
Well, so let me say it's the model is what happened when we moved from farms to factories, from countryside to city, and the locus of value moved from land to capital. Mm-hmm. That was a very brutal, difficult thing, which involved the rise of fascism, communism, and New Deal democracy. It was hundreds of millions of people died at the hands of other humans trying to make industrialization work for the masses. We did eventually. But the next one was from factories to services. It started in the 70s. Yeah. And that caused a lot of problems. Then it got going in the 90s with globalization and outsourcing of factories. And we have not had a resolution of that.
Right.
People are angry. They're feeling vulnerable. They're feeling attacked as communities, not just in the United States, although it's perhaps worse here. And there has been no resolution.
Right.
Now, on top of that, we're going to have to go from service jobs to sheltered service jobs. In other words, jobs that robots can't take and telemigrants can't do. Now that will involve lots of people changing jobs, and they will be very upset about that. So that's why I think we're really looking at an upheaval, that we have this base of, you know, anger. Just look at the yellow vest, for instance. Where did that come from?
The yellow vest in France.
In France, yeah. And that just came up all of a sudden, and now we put in this extra part. So that's what I'm really worried about. Well, this is an inflection point when we haven't resolved the move from factories to offices.
Right. And, you know, another word for upheaval is revolution.
Well, it doesn't always go that far. It's revolution, repression, or, revolution, repression, or, resolution. So revolution, repression, or resolution. One way or another, it leads to backlashes. So, like, say, in 1848, when there was a big backlash against industrialization, there was very few revolutions, lots and lots of violence, and then they suppressed it and moved on.
Right. Well, that's encouraging.
Cheering. Yeah.
Yes. I had an interesting question here. Someone was saying, well, you know, since we're talking about these service jobs, and they are dependent upon highly skilled, highly educated individuals, and so someone in the audience equates the question of what happens to those who are taking out significant amounts of money to build their skills, right? And they call it the student loan bubble.
Right.
Are we heading towards a student loan bubble popping as a result of this inability to actually fill these service sector jobs that these universities and these highly leveraged individuals are now betting on with their future?
It's a possibility. It's a strong possibility. And I like to reason by analogy. And the clearest analogy here is in law. And the legal profession is flattening out. The pyramid that used to build up to partnership is pretty much disappearing. And so there's many, many fewer lawyers. And young lawyers are having trouble finding real law jobs, both in the UK and here, things with e-discovery and Revel, and there's a bunch of these automated law things. And those people who borrowed $100,000 to become a lawyer, and now the first few steps are pretty hard to find, I think they're going to be angry. So I do worry about that. And deep down, we need to go to shorter, more general training, and then retrain as we need.
Right, which then again both involves our institutions, our current institutions in whatever form they are, and with universities, we're talking about institutions in many cases that have been around for hundreds of years,
right,
that tend to be rather slow to change when it comes to their approach.
Yeah, I heard a quip that universities are 19th century institutions staffed in the 20th century trying to address 21st century problem. All three of those things is wrong, but anyways, it sounds good. It's basically the entire, I've been a professor my entire life, and my father was a professor, so I'm imbued in this. But we look in the back mirror when we see what's going on,
yes.
And it's starting to change a little bit in business schools and some engineering schools and medical schools, where they're kind of engaging more in a vocational active thing, but a large amount of the academia is not appropriate for this sort of stuff, I think, or will have to change.
Right. You know, there's a question here about not just these service sector folks and changes, but rather the question is, will people in rural areas get further left behind? I mean, or have they already just sort of plateaued at this point? I mean, we still have to get, you know, crops, you know, planted and picked, and food to market, you know, rather field to fork has to exist.
Right.
So are we kind of done there?
So a lot of this remote work is starting already remote America rather than remote Philippines or Mexico or something. So I've talked to CEOs of companies and banks in New York, and they have a hard time hiring talent. And so they often outsource it domestically, you know, telecommuting to upper state New York or Connecticut, where, you know, $15-$20 an hour, that's not a bad salary if you're paying low costs and things like that. So I think up to this time, it's actually been helping the rural communities participate in the service sector through telecommunication and collaborative software. But I'm a little worried that rug is about to be taken out. So I do worry about the place-based anger, and this is not going to make it easier.
You know, I know we're going to talk about the upside. Really, we're going to get there really soon. But we still have a couple of questions, and one of them raises the question of demographics. And I think it's true that in developed nations, we're seeing a drop-off in our demography. We're aging. We're finding that we're not achieving replacement rates in some of the countries. Certainly, it's true in many of the countries in Europe where you live.
Right. In Japan
is another case in point. And these are, in fact, many of the nations that have also the highest skilled and most educated populaces.
Mm.
So how do you square the demographic changes that are occurring today, this graying of these populations, with what it is that will be that is occurring as we move towards the globotics upheaval?
Well, so I think, you know, aging is a huge problem. I spend a lot of time in Japan, and I'm on an advisory board for METI, for instance, and aging has been for 10 years a major issue for them, both macro slowdown and everything. And they're hoping that automation and telemigration helps them with the aging. So that's one of their hopes. And I think, you know, in an aging society, this fills in the gaps. So we always talk about skill gaps. This helps you fill it in over the telephone or, you know, internet and telepresence. So in principle, I think it helps aging societies adjust, and it also, you know, helps feed the demand side of this whole equation, that as the accountants retire or the lawyers retire, you can get in put telemigrants to help replace, not lawyers and doctors because of regulatory things, but their assistants or people help them.
Right, and these older populations tend to have resources as well, so there is an ability to actually transfer some of those resources
right.
into another generation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about why this is going to make us happy.
Okay.
I'm ready for the upside of
the upside.
All
okay.
This.
So, as you know, you may have noticed, I'm worried about the short term, and I think the fundamental problem is that job displacement is driven at the pace of digital technology. And all these AI geniuses are making money by replacing workers. And job creation is driven by human ingenuity and entrepreneurship, which is progressing at its usual leisurely pace. And I am quite sure that we'll get all the jobs we need in the world, just like we did when we left the farms to the factories. And when people left the farms, they had no idea what they would be making. They never heard of pharmaceuticals, never heard of electric fans. But they had an idea what they were going to do when they left the farm. They're going to be in a factory doing some relatively manual, repetitive work. And when we left the factories and went into the offices, many of the services we eventually provided, we hadn't even heard of when we started in the 1970s. So similarly, I think we ought to stop asking what jobs will appear and ask what will those jobs be like. Now, there's a very simple principle here. That is, we will do what the globots can't. So whatever AI can't do, we will do. So whatever remote workers can't do, we will do. Now, if you follow, that's just a process of elimination because the AI on the margin is so cheap and the telemigrants on the margin are quite cheap. So what we have to think about is what AI can't do and what telemigrants can't do. Now, there's some studies, like McKinsey Global Institute did a study on what AI can't do in the workplace. And they have seven different categories. What share of American jobs right now using these skills are automatable? And it goes from like 2/3 for gathering data and processing it down to managing and motivating people where it's like 6 or 7%. Mm-hmm. And if you squint your eyes, the things that it has trouble doing are the most human tasks that we do because we don't have big structured data sets. So dealing with unknown situations, applying empathy or ethics or being creative or motivating people or educating people, dealing with large groups to coordinate them motivate them. Anything with groups of people, AI is not good at this, partly because you just can't gather a data set on how you do that. So what my advice is, if you look around yourself, your job is like a list of chores you have to do. And some of those things you could get a structured data set on. Some of it you couldn't. The things you can't get a structured data set on, that's what all our jobs will be doing in the future. And you go to the office sometimes, a meeting, and the question isn't absolutely clear. And the outcome of the meeting isn't absolutely clear, but we all made progress. Now that's the sort of thing where you need human intuition and empathy and understanding and building trust and social networks. Those are the things that AI won't do. So those are the things we will be doing. And then if you go to remote intelligence or telemigrants, the only thing they can't do, since they are actually humans, is be in the same room. So the jobs of the future will require you to actually be in the same room with other people or things like machines. Everything else will be done by telemigrants. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but that means that the jobs of the future will be more human and more local. And since we'll be more productive, we'll be richer. And since this is Northern California, you'll be more generous. What a great place. It'll be like Downton Abbey where all the work's done by robots, right? But I do think that the jobs that will be left are dictated by what AI and RI can't do. And that's the trouble with most people. They're thinking, they're fascinating. Oh my goodness, they can do this, they can do that. We have to think what they can't do and move our skill set into that. And naturally that's, will be... Maybe you saw the movie, is it called She or Her?
Yes.
With the operating system, where the guy makes a living writing letters for other people,
right.
Like the most human thing. And actually the AI helps him out a little once in a while, but he needs that human touch. So that's a job in the future. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be a job, but it's a kind. I don't know if I've gone on too long, but I have one kind of fun thing.
Yeah, tell us the fun thing.
A fun thing. So there's an AI platform called Amelia from mm-hmm. IPsoft.
This is in Sweden.
She was first, one of the first applications within a Swedish bank,
uh-huh.
but it's just an AI platform.
Uh-huh.
At the end, there's this guy who developed this AI platform, but you can't help but saying she. It's a very presentational avatar. And the avatar was, as these things are, based on a real woman model and a very, sort of healthy, confident-looking woman. And so what this guy got was, the model's name was Amanda, and the platform's name is Amelia. And he got Amanda and Amelia on the stage at the same time and had a quiz show. And who do you think won? Amanda won, because they were general questions, and they weren't in Swedish. So, but if it had been about opening bank accounts and the questions that had been in Swedish, she would have got crushed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is every company will be running a competition between Amanda and Amelia. And Amanda, the human, will win on many things where the human dimension is strongest. And Amelia will win on the stuff where it's relatively repetitive or rule-based or anything like that. So that's the way we should think about our jobs. We want to be Amanda and deal with situations and talk naturally and confidently, not Amelia, where we learn how to, detect fraud in financial accounts 7 years at university or something like that. So that's my the Amanda Amelia story. I just love that one at the end.
So it sounds like the HR departments of the future will be a bunch of A-B testing between Amanda and Amelia, and that'll be...
I actually tried to do that in the book. I went through the testing thing, and I tried to see what Amanda was in there, but it didn't. The editor didn't like it. I had to take it out. Nobody understood it. But in any case, it was. I do think, if you think, apply a personality test to one of these Watson, IBM Watson, what can't they do? And that immediately moves you into the richness of human capacities. And you understand lots of this stuff, they will never be over in this corner. I can't remember what the corners are, but there's lots of them they're never going to do. And that's what we should be building up skills and directing our kids into them.
Wow. So, Richard, I happen to know that you do have children. I don't know their ages.
I do, yeah.
And so when you look at your kids, what do you advise them? How are you preparing them for this future? I know you're not being predictive about how these things are going to turn out. You've clearly told us you don't know which jobs exactly are going to be best. But what is it? How do you square your parenting with the way you're looking at the future?
Sure. Well, first of all, you're assuming my children listen to me. So
just like all children.
That's a problem.
Yes.
But in any case, they all left social science. My whole family is in economics. Everybody's in economics. They all did hard science. You know, one's going to be a doctor, one's a bioengineer, and one's a microengineer. So that's probably a good idea because that's exploding. But I definitely encouraged social skills, learning skills, motivating, empathy. I think ethics is an incredibly important thing that's underemphasized. But I think my kids, that train has left the station. But they're going to do good. I think they'll do well because they have these sorts of things. But sort of more generally, I think if I give advice to parents, it's first of all, remember the old rules don't work. The old rule was get more skills, more training, more education. And the reason that worked is because the more educated you were, the less likely it was that you worked in a sector that was competing with robots in China. You moved up into this non-traded, non-automatable service, and the more training you got, the further away you got from China and robots. That's not true anymore. You have to be way more subtle because the robots are coming for some of those head jobs and the telemigrants are coming for other ones. So you have to think about, and there's three simple principles. One, don't compete with AI. Mm-hmm. Don't go and spend 5 or 10 years doing pattern-based recognition. That's going to be gone. Two, don't compete directly with telemigrants. Don't get jobs where you can do it remotely because somebody else can do those much cheaper than you. And lastly, remember that humanity is your edge, not a handicap. So a lot of people are saying, oh, we all need to be tech and we need to code and we need... Well, of course, the table stakes in the jobs of the future will be that you are technologically fluent or literate. That's just the table stakes. But lots and lots of these tech jobs are automatable or telemigrants can do them. So your humanity, your ability to deal with people, to be creative, to innovate, to make things work, that's your edge.
Count on your heart. Look to humanity. Consider the importance of ethics in our everyday life and in our future world. And that will be what actually allows us not only to survive, but actually to thrive in this future, which from a distance may look dystopian, but which also holds, as with all major changes, great opportunities. And thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about this and for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Richard Baldwin. He's a professor at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. He's also the author of a new book, The Globotics Upheaval. This program was moderated by my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.